Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is the fifth episode of the Driving Eureka podcast. In the first segment, our feature story, it's time to do one of two things that matter in life. Our Driving Eureka book segment is about the release of the book Driving Eureka and a little bit about the book introduction. And our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy is about having a tasting room for your whiskey business, and also enough space. And of course, our craft cocktail recipe, the Singapore Sling. Okay, this is Driving Eureka, where we're going to cover off the fifth newsletter that Doug put out on November 15th, 2018. And I really like this newsletter especially because you talk about this. And I want you to talk, Doug, too, about your appreciation for Ben Franklin, because I know that's kind of a big thing with you. But this first section, it's time to do one of two things that matter in life. And it's a great quote from Ben Franklin. Doug, I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, so this week was the release of my seventh book, Driving Eureka, and the Franklin quote: "Either write something worth reading, or do something worth writing." Has me really thinking. I saw it up on the wall in a building, and either write something worth reading or do something worth writing, and it kept me thinking about it. And the more and more I thought about it, and I am a Franklin nut, okay? He was America's first-great inventor, first-great entrepreneur. He's just somebody that, as a young child, I got his biography and read it. And like, there's many people who this has happened to. And I just really relate to him as an inventor and as a writer and as an entrepreneur. And so I thought about this quote quite a bit, and I finally came to an observation on one plane flying over somewhere, and I decided I think what Franklin's speaking to us about is two things. When he says write something worth reading, it's about creating something that really stirs the heart and soul. And this art can be the written word, it can be painted art, it can be performed theater, or even craft food or whiskey. It's about doing something for the sake of the it, where it's an artistic expression. And my book, North Pole Tenderfoot, comes the closest to this of all the things I've written, because it's not generally what I do. It is as close to poetry in a book. Ernest Hemingway said famously, you know, in his first trip to Africa, he really saw it, and after that, he didn't. And so, having read that, I did meticulous notes, even at 40 below zero, and took very good notes and had recordings from it to truly try to make you feel what it was like to be there. And the trip itself is not worth doing. I mean, it's a ridiculous thing for a person to do, and there's no, you know, greater good that's done by this. It just is. The book, though, hopefully stirs the soul and does something for you. It matters, the book writing. And in fact, it's that in Driving Eureka, in the back, it's the first time ever, I put an excerpt from the North Pole Tenderfoot book because I thought it bookended nicely with this. So that's write something worth reading. The other one is do something worth writing. It's about doing something that stirs the head and the soul and then writing about it. So it's about doing something. And that something can be a business. Business, a nonprofit, a product, service, a system, it can be anything. But you're doing something and then you're telling the world about it. And Driving Eureka is my absolute best example of this, of doing something worth writing. It's a new academic field. It's applying systems thinking from Dr. Deming to innovation. It's about how to unleash the talent in your organization by enabling innovation by everyone, everywhere, every day. And it really makes it come to life. And so this is less of a book written with poetry, though one tries, but it's really more to be descriptive, to tell you how to do this, to report on it, where write something worth reading, the writing is in itself the end output to stir the soul. And I came to the conclusion that when he says write something worth reading or do something worth writing, this is what he's doing, and that both of these approaches are very worthy missions, and both bring meaning to life. It's kind of an interesting way to look at the quote, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
When I first heard the quote, I was thinking in terms of Ben Franklin challenging us to do something, either write something worth reading or do something worth writing. You've obviously taken it to another level, saying that to write something worth reading is an end output, and to do something worth writing is a how to do something. So yeah, no, I think it's a good interpretation. You've obviously internalized it a lot and thought about what this quote means to you and how it played out in writing Driving Eureka.
You know, we tend to be a culture that tends to believe in the arts, or we believe in business. But there's something to be said for having a little bit of both of these. I mean, it's interesting. I remember a research I reported in one book where they did surveys of scientists, and the number of top-notch scientists that also do art is disproportionately high. And I'm wondering if they're just basically tapping into their left and right brains, if it's a whole brain dimension that's making this happen.
You know, I wonder, and especially since it's a quote that came from Ben Franklin, was there a setting for that, or was that just in like Poor Richard's Almanac? Where was that quote taken from?
Well, historically, it would have been Poor Richard's Almanac, and he also was a liberal plagiarizer and twister. So
okay.
He probably saw something like this, and oftentimes he would take a quote and just twist it a little bit more. But he used liberally from others of things that he'd seen. So I don't know this specific one of any basis for it. But
I was just curious on the history of that, and if it showed up in some writing, some context of a political writing, or just a general life. It's almost like a theory or you know, a challenge, maybe would be a better word. So the question, Doug, is how? I mean, how do you get started writing something worth reading or doing something worth writing?
Yeah, the getting started is quite difficult for many people. Ernest Hemingway, the author, who's one of my favorite authors, I think gives us a pathway to find this way to get started in his book, A Movable Feast. He writes, "It was wonderful to walk down the long flights of stairs, knowing that I'd had good luck working, or in this case, writing. I always worked until I had something done. But sometimes when I was starting a new story and I could not get it going, I would sit in front of the fireplace and squeeze the peel of the little oranges into the edge of the flame and watch the sputter of blue that they made. I would stand and look out over the roofs of Paris and think, do not worry. You've always written before and you will write now. All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know. So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there." I mean, this is kind of cool. He says, stop boiling the ocean. Write one true sentence. If you want to write something worth reading, write one true sentence. If you want to do something worth writing, then take the first step. Make the first meaningful act towards it. And then take the next step and the next step. I guess he's basically saying, just get started. Just get started.
So it's kind of like a object at rest stays at rest and one in motion stays in motion type of an analogy.
Basic physics. Yeah, basic physics. That's what we're talking. It's basic physics. You know, You've got it. And so just try to take what's the first significant step, a meaningful step, a tangible thing that you could do. Or write the word. And I'll tell you, I find the same thing. When I write books, I write almost every single morning. And when I sit there and sometimes I don't know what to write, I just start writing and writing and writing. We call it free writing. And then eventually I write something meaningful. And then I'm off from there. But so many people worry that they can't do the whole thing that they never start. They never start.
That's interesting. So it is then the equivalent. You kind of applied that from a writing standpoint. Is then the equivalent in innovation coming up with ideas? Is it using kind of the innovation engineering or that system that you outlined in Driving Eureka? Is that kind of the first step from an innovation standpoint?
No, it can be, but it could be just taking the time to learn. I mean, listening to these podcasts, reading one of the newsletters, getting subscribed. It could be any step where you start to prepare your brain. It could be organizing a team. It could be creating an idea. But do something that's mean. It doesn't. It's just a sentence. It's just a step. It doesn't have to be that big as inventing the idea. I mean, that may be too much for people. It's like, you know, telling somebody that wants to get in better shape, okay, let's run Boston Marathon this weekend. And it's like dude, I can't do that, man. I got to just – can I walk around the block first? You know, you just got to get started. Got to get started. And I think we overthink this stuff now. We don't give virtue to the – artistic side as much as the more commercial side, I think, is probably a fair statement.
Okay. And just want to put this into the podcast. What you've always kind of liked Ben Franklin. What's the story behind that?
I just always believed I got his book at a young age, his biography, as many people did, that really inspired me. And there's something about Franklin being an inventor, an author, scientist, entrepreneur, a real Renaissance person. And myself, I find it the same. I mean, I like that eclectic collection of different things, whether it's making pizza, whiskey, or the bagpipes, which I'm a big supporter of, in my beloved Prince Edward Island, Canada, where we have a home.
Yeah, I didn't know about the bagpipe thing until this newsletter. That's interesting.
It's time now for the Driving Eureka book excerpt with legendary inventor Doug Hall.
The book is out, and here we go, full speed ahead. What are you going to be doing as far as the book opening and celebrating? How is that all going to happen?
Driving Eureka out now is my seventh book, and it is amazing how much since the 90s, early 90s, when my first book came out, how much the world of books has changed. I mean, you know, it's just different. I mean, there used to be book reviewers and used to do book tours and I mean, it's just different. Now it's bloggers and podcasts and digital packages, and it's exciting. It's exciting. It's a totally different world. And so we're doing some unique things this time. We've got a video workbook so that you can use it as a as part of a book club, sort of a guided book club. You read a chapter, you watch a little video, you do some exercises, you talk about them, where a team can go through it. We've had a bunch of people really love this. Audiobook, the full 10 hours. It's out on all the major platforms for Driving Eureka. We also have a one-hour abridged summary for people with short attention spans that you can go through. And so there's just going to be a lot. The podcast is new, driving a lot of this stuff together. So it's part of building a community. I mean, we've taught about 35,000 people innovation engineering right now. And it's really a community that we're growing it, and it really is a Robin Hood type thing. I mean, we charge large corporations fair prices, and we use that to subsidize students on campus and people working with nonprofits, et cetera.
Cool. Yeah. So what is this Pat's Pizza? I'm curious. I saw this pizza on there, and I have to say I'm hungry. So that pizza looks pretty good.
Yeah. So the photo up on in the show notes, I've taken pictures of the book now in different places just to give it a little bit of fun, because again, that's one of them social media things. You're supposed to do that stuff, you know. You need the good pictures. And so I'm trying to have some fun with it. In this case here, there's a place. I went to the University of Maine in Orono, as did much of my family back three generations. And so Pat's Pizza is kind of legendary. And so the picture here is of Pat's Pizza. And people that have been to the ranch know we have like three pizza ovens, and we do a wonderful pizza experience for people. And it's just fun. It just makes it fun.
That's good. Now, I didn't know about this fascination with the bagpipes. You have to tell me about what that, because I knew the pizza. I mean, you've done the pizza thing. We've talked about the whiskey because it's part of what we're doing now. But what's with the bagpipes?
Well, my mom's family came from Thurso, Scotland. Prince Edward Island is where my wife and I have a home, where we spend large parts of the year, which is in Canada, eastern Canada, made famous by Anne of Green Gables. People may know that. It also happens to be the place outside of Scotland and Ireland with the highest concentration of Celtic heritage anywhere in the world. It was heavily settled by the Celts, and it happens to be the home of the College of Piping and Celtic Performing Arts of Canada. And so it is an amazing institution. My wife and I support it. She's actually on the board of the college. We've done, any island child age 8 to 18 can take bagpiping or drumming at no cost. We've done some 50,000 lessons that we've paid for over the years. And so it's just amazing. And these kids who, you know, and I don't dish it because you wouldn't know it to visit. It's just beautiful. It's an amazing place. But per capita, the income is pretty rough. It's not a wealthy place. A lot of farmers' kids, fishermen's kids, et cetera. And, you know, have to struggle day to day oftentimes with the weather and the rest of it and the markets that go up and down in prices. And despite that, these amazing kids competing at the world championship have won the world championship just recently. They did, and which is amazing. And the newspaper was great. It said, you know, College of Piping World Championships, UK wins 7, Scotland wins 7, Canada 1. And it was glorious. And here, these kids competing against adults took the world championship, which is we're very proud of them. Very proud of them.
Very good.
It's quite wonderful.
That's cool. I didn't know that story. So that's just another interesting tidbit then about Doug Hall.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this book opening.
We've talked about the book because we were talking about a pre-release, but I thought it would be good. I'm just going to paraphrase a little bit from the opening of the book, the introduction. And that opening is a big thing for me. And I thought I'd bookend it. I'd do the opening this week, and next week I'll do the closing. So then you've got the start and the stop. Okay. You can find out if you want to learn the parts in the middle. And the book opens with me writing, "The aim of this book is to teach you how to create a meaningful difference with your career, team, company, and community. This is accomplished through the innovation engineering system for thinking faster, smarter, and more creatively." Now, the need to think smarter, faster, and more creatively is broadly accepted in today's fast-changing world. What is not understood is how to do it. Innovation engineering teaches you and everyone you work with a reliable system for creating fresh ideas, and even more importantly, how to turn them into reality more successfully. And as you'll learn in Chapter 13, when just 10% of your team, 10% of your team, company, or community has unshakable belief in their ability to innovate, a culture of innovation is created. Innovation engineering defines innovation in two words: meaningfully unique. When a product, service, work system, or job candidate is meaningfully unique, customers are willing to invest their time, energy, and money into it. The never-ending quest for meaningful uniqueness is at the heart of this book, my life, and the innovation engineering movement. Now, each of our students defines meaningfulness differently. Some find meaning in improving manufacturing, government, or even high school, junior high school teaching systems. Others find meaning from creating smarter methods for rehabilitating prison inmates, caring for nursing home residents, or growing the impact of a nonprofit. Some students find meaning in the invention of amazing new food products, medical devices, internet services, financial services, or industrial equipment. The breadth and depth of application we are observing from application of the innovation engineering mindset and methods is both amazing and humbling. So that's the opening few paragraphs. And as you can see, we're not thinking small with this movement. I mean, we truly are thinking about how can we change the world? How can we make a difference that matters? So a way to think about it is that you're going to learn from somebody who's doing exactly what they're saying. I mean, people want to believe. I truly believe. People want to believe. They don't – they're not happy. People are not happy. They're not doing things that are bringing them true – Dr. Deming said, what's the purpose of his stuff? To help people find joy in work. And joy in work is not about, you know, having cool gimmicks and pool tables and ping pong games around. It's about finding meaning in the stuff you're doing. And every single thing we do, whether it be in our courses, whether it be in our methods of testing, whether it be our ways of creating – we're looking to create meaningful uniqueness. We're looking to write meaningful uniqueness, to develop it. That is the North Star. That is our destination, and it is the singular destination that this is about. And so if you want to find more meaning, if you want to do something more meaningful, that's what this is about. And you know, it's funny, as I'm on the cusp of, you know, turning over that next decade to age 60 – you know, you reflect on these things and you start to think about, why am I here? And I truly think it is about helping people get to meaningfully unique, doing something that matters, whether it's a whiskey business or it's a school. I mean, it doesn't matter. Whatever is your world, whatever floats your boat, that's the amazing thing. Whatever turns you on, that's what we're here to help you do it faster, cheaper, and more effectively.
Okay. And there's one quote in there that I think is significant. I don't want to go by without a little bit of conversation about it, is that to achieve a critical mass. Now, I remember you and I having a conversation some time back about Dr. Deming saying that, you know, the square root of an organization is how many people you need in order to change the culture in an organization to challenge existing norms, those types of things. And then you found some research, and that's why I don't want to go by this 10% that you can get that 10%. You want to talk to that a little bit as far as where the 10% came from, and it's significant because most people think, God, there's no way I'm ever going to get the whole organization to change.
That's right. Yeah, this came out of some research, and it's a little bit spooky because it was funded by military. So I'm not sure if they're using this to figure out what it's to take to take over a country or what it is.
You never know.
But the research found that when you get 10% with unshakable belief, then the change happens. And before 10%, it looks like nothing's happened. It would take longer than the time of the universe for change to happen. It just doesn't happen. And it gives you hope that not only can you change – if you can't get the leader to lead – say that one more time. If you can't get your leader to lead, no whining. Take responsibility for your sphere of influence. Just start. And how about now? Right now. You know, let's get started. Read the damn book. Listen to the audio if you have to. Although I got to tell you, listening to 10 hours of me talking, I mean, I can't even imagine anything more painful than that. but I know people love them. People love them. I'm not an audiobook person. I'm a written book person. But whatever works for you, awesome. Want to get a group of people, do it as a group, as a book club, get together every Saturday morning and do 3 chapters together. Do it. But do something. Do something and get going. And then when you get it, then other people will get it, and then another, and another, and another, and that's how revolutions happen. It doesn't take much. It doesn't take much. But if you're trying to get them all, forget it. It's not going to happen.
I think that's
concentrate our force.
Yeah, I think that's an important point for people to understand and make. And the you know, it's not changing everybody's mind. It's changing you know, a significant, really few that can really change things.
Well, the other thing, Trip, that you find is it's not like we're asking them to do something difficult. We're asking them to do more meaningful things, to become focused on learning, collaborating with others, and experimenting. Is there something in there that sounds like it's going to be painful? This is fun. This is more fun. I mean, it's not like we're saying you need to lose 30 pounds. That's not fun. Okay? That's not fun. But it is fun to when you learn stuff, when you're on a team and collaborating with others, and when you're running experiments and you're interested to see. That's fun. And so it's not like it's a difficult thing that we're asking. We're not asking for any magical stuff here. Okay, I'm not going to tell you there's some magic silver bullet. It's about rewiring the brain and your thinking system. That's all it is.
This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we're going to take you behind the scenes on what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company like has never been done before. Let's start the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy with the cliffhanger you left us with in the last episode, which is giving us the distillery logistics and also this craft cocktail recipe, the Singapore Sling. And based on the fact that you just visited there, I'm sure we'll hear a little bit about your travels there, too.
Yeah, so I thought this week it would be good to get you into some stuff that nobody taught you. Because I know as we were getting our distillery, we're only a couple of years in here, and as we were putting things together, we operated under another person's DSP first. We got it registered, and we did it there. So we're literally just about to open up our own physical space. So we've been operating out of somebody else's space when you file with the TTB, and you can do that for those of you involved in it. But one of the things that we learned, we've learned a number of things as we've put this together, and we've talked with all kinds of people about it, but somehow they missed some certain things. So if you're going into the going to create a craft spirits company, or whether you're going to do gin or whiskey or whatever it is, and whether you're going to do it the classic way of distilling, or you're going to work with some stuff that we're doing, which gets you up and going a lot faster and cheaper, whatever it is. A couple of things that you got to think about. Really think hard about your tasting room, because anywheres from 20 to 50% of your sales and profits may come right from that spot. It depends on state laws or provincial laws or, you know, the country laws if you're in other parts of the world. I forget now, we're doing a podcast. There's no boundaries to this. It plays on planet Earth. It's a whole new world, boy. Isn't it exciting? And so depending upon the rules on how it works, you know, you make money selling bottles, but you make a lot more money selling drinks. You know, you make a drink, it'll be, you know, probably 80, 85% profit margin, gross profit. Make bottles, you know, you probably make 50% is what you're going to shoot for. Sometimes a little bit better. But, you know, on average, it'll average out at the end of the day, maybe about 50% by the time you do taxes and all the rest of this craziness that you have to pay. And so that tasting room is really important. And really think about it. And it's for that reason that, you know, we're operating out of Kentucky in a place, and we looked at a lot of different places for it, and we decided to put it, come over the Ohio River, just a few miles over and from Kentucky, and put it in at the Eureka Ranch, because one, we have a large property here, but also we've got this magnificent ranch building that has this huge bar and this huge, you know, 30-foot tall stone fireplace and this huge great room on the side of a lake. And I'm like, my God, you know, this is a multi-million-dollar facility, and on Friday nights and Saturdays, I can use it as a tasting room, and it's already paid for. You know, I mean, that works. The math works. And so we renovated buildings here on the property, and we're building some new buildings on the property. And so, but getting that space right is really, really important. It's really important that you can make that work as a commercial space.
So is this something, Doug, you found from the distilleries that you've worked with to this point, as far as the tasting room, that's where the profitability comes from? And I guess it helps then the demand, obviously, for then the product itself, being bought.
Yeah, it really does. And in some states, it's really huge, depending upon the way the state laws are. Mm. But breweries are the same way. I mean, very high amount of sales and profits are made on location. I mean, it really is hyper-local. And so you've got to have that as your base to make money on. There's some restaurants that are complaining that, you know, breweries and distilleries are competing unfairly, you know, because they're basically competing with them as restaurants or bars. And if they had to deal with the taxes that we have to deal with, whether it's federal or state and three-tier distribution systems and all the craziness that you have to deal with, I don't think it's a bad thing at all. We've got to do things like this because you've got to be able to sell it by the drink if you want to make money. I mean, it's really important. And you also sell tchotchka shirts and all that kind of junk that people want because they want to be at the place and all that stuff. But, you know, you've got to have a business there. And you've got to want to be in the restaurant business. You've got to want to be in the restaurant or bar business. If you don't want to be in the restaurant, if you just want to make whiskey and go do it, it's going to be really tough to make your math work. It's going to be extremely tough. You better have a whole lot of money to get into this business because it's going to take a long time for you to be able to build awareness and distribution.
Now, are you saying that, Doug, from a craft whiskey standpoint or a craft spirit standpoint?
I'm saying it for any spirit.
Okay.
Period.
Okay.
You know, but primarily the craft guys. You know, you've got to have, even if you wanted to be a, you know, say you wanted to make something big, you know, doing something with a hotel chain, or you're going to have some retail business as a backbone to get it going. I just don't know of another way to do it, realistically.
Okay. All right.
The second thing that you're going to find out is if you are at all successful, you're not going to have anywhere near enough room. So make sure you're thinking about how you're going to expand the space. And what you don't need is more space for distilling. That's like no space. Hmm. And people spend all the time around the shiny copper still, and that's the key thing. That is not what the problem is. The problem you're going to find is the warehouse space. The bonded warehouse space, which is where you've got alcohol before it's had the tax paid on it, and where you have to control it, and the unbonded space. It's for, because, I mean, when you get a little bit of flow, the empty bottles are sitting there. The empty bottles go into cartons, go get liquid in them, get a label on it, go into a carton. Now you've got full cases that are waiting to be shipped out. You've got, in many cases, you've got whiskey aging. So you've got work. I mean, you know, we talk about in lean, they talk about work in process. My God, the amount of stuff you've got in process. And if you're small, you get killed. Because the price of buying a small amount of bottles and stuff kills you. So you have to buy more. And next thing you know, you've just got warehouses full of junk. I mean, it's just huge volumes. I mean, this stuff takes up – and thank God it's whiskey. It's better than beer. I can't even imagine what the beer guys have to go through. I mean, you see these places where they've got the cans stacked up to the ceiling. I mean, the volumes that a beer guy has to do are even worse. But it just surprises you because you tend to think – about the whiskey making and that kind of stuff. But if you've got to have a rick house, you've got to store barrels, then you got to dump the barrels, you got bottles. I mean, that same product is taking up, you know, needs some volume. Because I know we've gone up 10x in sales this year. And next year we're going up 5x again. And you just do a little bit of paper to pencil to paper. And you quickly go, oh, my frickin' Lord, how many pallets do I have to have? And what kind of flow am I going to get? And so we're working on systems for that. So really think about that. You're going to underestimate the amount of space that you're going to get. And related to that, I know a group I know a couple of groups that have been looking to buy. I mean, we're not for sale or anything, but who are looking to buy craft distillers. And one of the things that they've told me that has held them back from certain purchases is that they said they had no capacity. Even if they wanted to make them big, they were either landlocked in a city and there was no space. I mean, for all intents and purposes, they had to start a new place in order to make the math work. I mean, they had a brand and maybe a recipe, but that was about it. There's just no stock. There's no volume for it. So I'm not talking about building it big, but you got to think through the plan for how you're going to do that.
Okay. That is some interesting things that you found as far as the distillery piece. Let's move to the last section here on your craft cocktail recipe, since you hadn't been too long since you've been back from Singapore. And I've actually had a Singapore sling before. I don't know what was in it because I only drink it. I am not familiar with Raffles Long Bar in Singapore. Why don't we start there?
So Raffles Hotel, named after Raffles, who came, I think he was an Englishman who came to Singapore and the area and helped develop it. The Raffles Hotel is very famous, and there's at the end of it, there's a bar called the Long Bar. It's up on the second floor. And I've been to Singapore a couple of times. And the first time I was there, it was rustic, I think it would be a name. A bit of a rickety staircase. You went up there. Charmingly rustic, I guess is what you would say.
Okay.
And this time when I was there, I was a little bit unsure because I'd heard that the hotel was under construction. I thought I wasn't there, but they knew enough to open up the Long Bar first because the tourist is coming through. Well, I want to go get the place where the Singapore sling was originally invented. And so they make Singapore slings, and they make a lot of them. In fact, they have a mixing machine. I'll send you the video on it. We can put it up on the website. They have an automated mixing machine for shaking the Singapore slings. It's hilarious. And I took some video of it. And so we stopped in, and we might have had a couple of these things. And so the new building is a bit disappointing. I said it was sort of like it had been Disneyfied. It was just very prim and proper how they've made it up. It looks like Walt Disney's view of what an old Singapore bar would be like. You know, it's
like a movie set then, or a ride, yeah, or something.
Bit, yeah. I mean, they got like the palms that you would breeze. They've got some of those on a metal bar that automatically goes back and forth. Like it's a bit cheesy. Okay. No, it's like a lot cheesy. And I had pictures from the last time I was there, and I looked at the bar, and the new bar is made to look like the old bar, but it's not the old bar. And the whole place is, I mean, it's fine, but it's just doesn't have the grit that it had before. But the cocktails are still good. Although I did would point and poke them a little bit because they aren't squeezing the juices. The volume they're doing, I guess, is pretty big. And so here's the drink. And again, the brand, in the case here, the brand names really matter. They really do matter. And so to a tall glass of ice, add 1.5 ounces of gin.
What gin?
Add 1.5 ounces of gin. The gin's a little bit open, but I would tend to use Beefeaters or Gordon's, a classic London dry. I would tend to use one of those.
Okay.
A 1/2 ounce of cherry herring, which is a cherry liqueur. 1/4 ounce of Cointreau, which is an orange liqueur. 1/4 ounce of Benedictine. 1/2 ounce fresh squeezed lime juice. 2 ounces of fresh squeezed pineapple juice. A dash of Angostura bitters. And then you're going to stir it gently. and add a splash of 7-Up. And garnish it. You'll take it like a toothpick and take some cherry and pineapple to add to it and add that to it. And it's a wonderful, refreshing, long drink that's quite fun.
Yeah, they're tasty. Well, there's a lot going on inside those drinks, obviously, that I didn't have any idea what the ingredients were at the time. You know, I got to ask this, and maybe it's going to be in one of the upcoming craft cocktail recipes, but I got to believe there's a Doug Hall something. Doug Hall 1, you know, maybe it's on Doug Hall 62 now. I don't know.
That's a good one. You know, maybe we're going to have a bit of a party here. Martin Luther King weekend is going to be the official opening of the distillery here in Cincinnati. And that's our official opening. And we've got some wonderful musicians from Prince Edward Island coming down and might have a little bit of a birthday party. We're going to release a special bottling for my birthday. I'm going to do, but you've got me going now. There will be a special cocktail too. I think I'm going to have to start on that. So.
Oh, good.
Do it. To do. And that's the fun thing about this stuff, folks. I mean, the fun thing about these things is make a cocktail for family and friends, make it and enjoy it, invent your own, play with it. I mean, it's simple. It's easy.
And send it to us.
Send it to
yeah. I mean, why not? Have them send it over and you know, if it's something worth mixing, we'll put it out there.
Send us a cool one. We'll send you a t-shirt. Send us a cocktail that the guys and I go, wow, that's cool. We'll send you a t-shirt. Okay. Send us a recipe that's meaningfully unique.
Very good. Hopefully we'll get some participants in that. I may do it just to come up with something, see if I can get a t-shirt, although you've always rejected my pizzas, so I'm not sure how good I'm going to do on mixed drinks.
Come on. Keep at it.
I'm still looking up at a 4, Doug, on your meaningfully unique scale, so I've got some work to do. All right, very good. Well, that concludes this portion. Any cliffhangers for us for the next Brain Brew Whiskey Academy?
No, but I'm going to end you with a quote this week. And it was a quote, I met a friend in Singapore who said this to me, and we had a wonderful 4-hour dinner, just a glorious Asian dinner. The tasting menu and had lots of laughs and talks. And he said this quote to me and I put it down and I just think I'd like to end the show this week with this. He said, "No one ever changed the world because their boss assigned the project to them." No one ever changed the world because their boss assigned the project to them. So what are you waiting for, folks? Let's get started.
Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for limited time 4 things. A 1-hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. A subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to fine filter and fast track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success. You answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.doughall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.